Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, a special look at two stories. One of them has received significant media attention, but you might not always have understood it. The other is a story that's flown under the media radar altogether. Turmoil in the housing market has been pinned on Wall Street's appetite for so-called subprime mortgages. With house prices declining and foreclosures going the other way, the media are now sifting through the debris to tell us what happened. But what should we have known all along? And who exactly is being rescued now? Journalist Nomi Prinz will join us to explain. Also on the show, despite its disturbing name, the virtual silence of the corporate press corps would have us believe the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act, now making its way through Congress, is nothing you need concern yourself about. Our guest is one who disagrees. We'll hear from Kamal Carl Franklin, Racial Justice Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. All of that's coming up on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
When it comes to understanding what's happening with the subprime mortgage meltdown and the related mess in the housing market, it's not exactly the lack of media coverage that's the problem. Making sense of what's in the press seems the more difficult task. A slow-motion crisis that failed to elicit much media attention is now covered in great detail as business reporters try to figure out what went wrong and when. Nomi Prinz is a journalist who covers, among other things, the world of Wall Street. It's terrain she knows well, having worked at places like Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns over the years. She's the author of the book Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and more recently, Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted For Them or Not. She's also a senior fellow at the think tank Demos. Nomi Prinz, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me here.
Now, the mechanics of subprime mortgages aren't very easy to understand. We should do our best, I guess, I suppose, to explain it. Nonetheless, you see them described sometimes as esoteric, which might be a little bit helpful. But what exactly was happening over the last few years?
Well, a couple things happened. First, let's go back to something we all know, which is Enron. And there's a definite connection between Enron and subprime in that when Enron was happening, it got all the markets spooked out. Things were collapsing. Everybody was yelling fraud. The meltdown happened in the stock markets, and Alan Greenspan, the head of the Fed, said, you know what? Things are pretty bad. I'm going to cut rates a lot of times, actually 12, but from 6% to 1.25%. And that's going to sort of pump money into the market and make banks borrow and lend and do more things and all of that, which happened. But at the same time, mortgages were generally occurring, and banks said, hey, you know what? We're not going to make a lot of money giving people mortgages at 3% interest, so we're going to figure out a way to give more people mortgages at like 15% interest or at like 10% interest and raise it later so that we know we're going to be able to get some money out of these mortgages. And we're going to find these people, and we're going to sell them these mortgages. And then we're going to take all those little mortgages and then we're going to roll them up into big pieces of trades that we can bat back and forth between each other and make money in yet another way. What started as Enron and led to a bunch of interest rate cuts created all this money that banks had to figure out a way to use to get more money out of their customers and just general regular borrowers in the country. And the way they found to do that was through these subprime mortgages, subprime meaning heavily interest-rated mortgages, and finding people to actually invest in those or effectively buy homes borrowing money that they couldn't pay back easily at the time and certainly not after their rates were raised on them.
It's interesting you bring up the connection to Enron. We'll get back to that. I think there is this sense that it happened almost organically, but the way you're talking about it and the way you've written about it was that it was really a targeting of a certain group of citizens, people who had less money, who you could kind of, I don't want to say trick, but you could trick into getting or signing up for this kind of loan.
Well, right. And it was also the reason it was related to that was because people are always or were always under the impression, certainly when the stock market was being glorified and pre-Enron when it was going up in value, that, You know, everybody was talking about being in the stock market. You know, anyone from a truck driver to a cab driver to, you know, someone in like seventh grade with their little portfolio that they were sharing in class, everyone could feel involved. And then when the stock market went down and Enron happened, what occurred was the new thing that one should be involved in and that was sort of pumped as the big better investment was homes. Because the argument was you could buy homes and you could flip them and you could borrow against them and you could sort of get all of your dreams, including your roof over your head, and that would be a more secure investment than the stock market. So instead of being called by brokers at Salomon Brothers or wherever to buy WorldCom, people were being more targeted to basically take out loans to buy homes. And those were the loans, some of which were subprime and with high interest rates or rates that moved against them over time. And some were actually just regular mortgages that also moved against them over time, which weren't subprime, but were just a different version of that same kind of lending.
It seemed like in the late 90s, you'd hear about everyone watching CNBC to watch the Dow. And then I suppose a few years later, there were these cable channels that were devoted almost entirely to the housing market and how to flip houses. It couldn't be easier. Well, on December 18th, the New York Times cataloged all the missed signals in this story. People were warning of the problems for years. Lo and behold, nothing much happened. This seems to be the media cycle we're in now, where the actual lending practices are explained better than they ever were before. Reporters are sorting through this wreckage to identify those early warnings that were ignored. And you brought up Enron, and it seems a little reminiscent of the collapse of Enron. We talked about it on the show with a reporter who said that colleagues in the business press didn't understand what Enron was doing, but Enron made you feel like that was your problem. Was the subprime market working the same way that, yeah, it's a little unorthodox, but that's the brilliance of it?
Well, actually, that's a good point, because in that situation of Enron, not only was it people's problem for not understanding the types of magnificent things Enron was creating, but it was also for a long time their fault that they had bought into this idea that they were being sold and bought the stock in Enron or WorldCom or the other scandals. And to some extent, it is a lot like that with subprime. It isn't to say that borrowers were stupid idiots, which is kind of how some of the media is trying to basically pin the blame on. It's basically the fact that when a lender is lending to a borrower, there's certain things that were checked, which is, you know, how their credit rating are. Can they pay back on these loans? And one of the things that was happening in the fine print were that subprime borrowers, first of all, they wanted to get in on those cable shows. You know, it's very alluring to own your own house and to fix it up and to flip it at a profit. All of that sounds great. And so when you're given the opportunity to borrow against that and for that dream, then the enticement's there. But what happened was the rates were basically raised on them while they were in the process of paying their payments by a lot. So if they were making a $700 or $800 a month payment, in 2 years, that could have ballooned and has ballooned to something like a $1,200 payment. So all of a sudden, any budgets that you had thought of and anything that you had filled out to get this loan to begin with is all of a sudden meaningless, and you're stuck with this higher payment.
Now, we should talk about what the consensus is on how to fix something like this. Over the summer, there was this talk of fixing this by cutting interest rates. The Fed should cut interest rates is what we heard all the time. You pointed out in one of the pieces that you wrote that CNBC's Jim Cramer made this passionate pitch that was bouncing around all around YouTube for a rate cut to help the little guy. The New York Times recently wrote an editorial that the rate cut wasn't doing enough to juice the economy. At the risk of sounding a little naive about these things, what are they talking about? What would a rate cut do for your average homeowner who finds themselves down a bit in their mortgage payment?
The fact is, rate cuts do absolutely nothing for someone already in their mortgage payment, the way our banking structure is set up, which is why it's kind of ironic that Jim Cramer was pleading with the Fed to cut rates. Cutting rates is kind of how we got into this particular subprime mess. Cutting rates during Enron was a way to supposedly give confidence back to the market, but really back to Wall Street and to the banks that really need that extra cash floating around to be able to borrow and to leverage and to do more of their own activity. So really, when the rates were cut recently, they really enabled a situation to occur, which was that banks could have an easier time with their balance sheets and their problems. But it's not like the rates were then push down to the borrowers who are having problems. But the important thing about all of this is that it's actually the banks, not merely because of the fact that now they have slightly cheaper money to work with, but the fact that they really took all these subprime mortgages, which they created in order to give themselves more interest to come into the banks to be used for other activities, that they actually also package these things. It'd be the equivalent of taking like a bunch of Legos and putting them together and sort of selling the Lego factory back to someone else for a much higher price. But it's all the little pieces that were all the mortgages that were really what's currently faulty. And if the pieces are faulty, the whole house is faulty. The whole Lego castle is faulty. And that's what's really been the cause of the meltdown. It's the selling of the castles that Wall Street's been doing back and forth during this entire time, which wasn't in the press, that really started crumbling first and that led to people's homes being devalued in addition to the fact that they weren't able to make higher payments.
And the housing bubble, which is sometimes discussed alongside this, certainly makes things worse in the sense that people now are in this house that not only is costing them more to stay in, but now is worth less than they thought it was.
And they can't get out of it.
Yeah. Well, the White House announced plans recently to save homeowners in trouble. The media coverage seemed better than usual on this. Most of the reports seemed to get that the White House was offering a pretty limited rescue plan here. You've written about changes made to something called the Glass-Steagall Act, which is something I don't see in the papers much.
Well, the Glass-Steagall Act was something that was created after the Great Depression in 1933 by the FDR administration. It basically said a very simple thing. It said banks can't both lend to people and take in their deposits and then use that money to speculate in other stuff that they're doing. It really just said there's a wall between those two activities. If you're going to deal with consumers, deal with them. If you're going to speculate, speculate, but don't use the money to speculate from ordinary people. And that was in place for many, many years. Actually, in 1999, it was fully dismantled after a lot of hacks at pieces of it. And it became possible for banks to both lend and borrow and use that money for speculation. And so what happened with subprime and the mortgage market is exactly that. Banks found a way to lend to people that were not traditional borrowers. They sucked more money out of them. They packaged those loans into different securities with which they then speculated in other ways. So the point of bringing back a wall between those two activities would protect the speculative side of a bank from preying on the regular consumer portion of a bank. And that's something that's not even really being discussed whatsoever at all in Washington.
Now, we should talk about winners and losers, obviously. It was odd to hear NPR announce recently that this crisis was about to envelop another victim, as they said, and this was a story about the resignation of the CEO of Citigroup, an odd candidate for victim status in this. But you do get a sense from some of the media conversation, well, that there are some people that just weren't supposed to have houses, and it was their fault for getting caught up in all this. How fair a characterization is that to pin the blame on the borrower in this scenario?
I mean, I think it's a really simplistic way of looking at the whole situation to say that it's the person who got qualified for a loan that then was changed on them. And the whole point of them being able to get that loan at that rate, at an exorbitant rate, was so that the banks could find investors of the packages of those loans. So really, when you blame the borrower, you're blaming a small piece of a much, much bigger puzzle that really were the banks trying to find a way to just extract more interest out of another base of people. If you want a home and you can't qualify any other way, and home buying is the thing that's important, you take out the loan. And most of those people paid off of those loans. Defaults and foreclosures only started happening when the rates of those loans changed. In a country where the government is so involved with creating debt in general for how the country runs, to blame borrowers for putting on some debt to buy homes just seems a little unfair.
Now, big picture, what are things people just aren't learning if they're reading this coverage? What's a big area or two that is just being missed still?
again, the one thing that's really being missed is that investment banks like Goldman Sachs, like Morgan Stanley, like Lehman Brothers, as well as the investment portions of banks like Citigroup and JP Morgan and others, were really, really taking these mortgages and doing a lot more with them from a trading perspective. That basically, they're trading people's homes for profit. And that's the thing that's really not been covered by the mainstream press. That's really what this entire thing boiled down to. Because the boom in housing was a situation in which some house prices in the last 7 years might have doubled. Most of the country at the most increased by 40% in value. But the things that went up a lot were the developers and the lenders and the speculators, some of which is stock quadrupled in value, much more than houses did. And that was because of trading and speculating on Wall Street.
We've been speaking with journalist and author Nomi Prinz. Her most recent book is Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not. Find her work online at nomiprinz.com. Nomi Prinz, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much.
You might think that at this point, any new legislation the Bush administration tried to advance in the name of fighting terrorism would receive serious scrutiny, given previous efforts that have turned out to be violations of civil liberties, if not laws, and given the well-founded concern that terrorism might turn out to be any actions or ideas officials don't like. But the scarily named Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act passed overwhelmingly in the House this October without much notice in the media. Nightly Network News brought us exactly zero stories on it. Columnist Saul Friedman wrote that he was told that congressional reporters felt the bill was so uncontroversial that it didn't amount to a story. Here to fill us in on the act and why it does merit our attention is Kamal Carl Franklin, Racial Justice Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Counterspin, Kamal Carl Franklin.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, since many listeners will have heard little or nothing about it, why don't you start off by telling us what this Too Uncontroversial to Report On Act is, what it aims to do?
Sure. The act begins off as creating a 10-member panel that is supposed to study homegrown terrorism and violent radicalization. And on its face, I guess for some people that may sound like it's kind of a needed thing to be done or something that could be uncontroversial. But the thing that the act does is that it establishes such far-reaching terminology and definitions for what violent radicalization could be or what ideologically based violence, two very prominent definitions that are part of the bill, that it basically allows them to investigate almost everything and anything. And what we think could happen with this bill, once it becomes law and this commission starts up, is that then they will begin to make recommendations after an 18-month term, and actually some of the recommendations will be made before the end of the term, on how to prevent violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism from taking place. And with the breadth of scope in terms of the, once again, definitional language, we think what this bill really does is propose a way to clamp down further on dissent and to catch acts of dissent and thoughts about dissent in the same breath as what's considered terrorism. And so we think it's a tool that the government will use to clamp down on ideas which they do not like. And I think that's really the scary part of the bill. Imagine, for instance, if the bill gets passed and they do make certain recommendations, which most of these commissions do, and they start passing laws that make certain acts that people would conduct in demonstrations would make those acts potentially terrorist acts. And I could talk a little bit more about why we think that's a possibility with this kind of study.
Well, please do, because in hearing your concerns, I'm wondering what you make of the line that we read in a few places that even though it sounds scary on paper, there's not really anything to fear here because the law doesn't really do anything. There was a line in a piece in Slate that said that it was something of a relief because of that, but that's not what I'm hearing from you.
No, because, I mean, these commissions are set up with the future prospect of sending recommendations which would become law. And the thing that's really scary about this is that this is housed both in the Senate and in the House as a joint commission. And so they would have that much easier opportunity to pass aggressive laws that could make certain activities terrorist activities. And once again, as you talked about earlier, The House passed this by a vote of 404-6. There was no Democratic opposition, no opposition, obviously, by the Republicans. In the Senate, we expect something similar to take place unless there's really an uproar about sort of narrowing or tailoring or even stopping this particular bill from becoming law. But we think that the danger is that they're going to make recommendations that will be criminal recommendations, like, you know, how would they think to stop homegrown terrorism is to pass criminal statutes, which, again, because of the breadth of the things that they're talking about, for instance, ideologically based violence is a prominent definition that's used. And the way it's talked about, that definition means the use, plant use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individuals. And it's the ors that you have to be careful of. So if you're in a demonstration and if you use a tactic that's been commonly used probably the last 50, 60 years, even longer than that in this country and other places, is civil disobedience. If you use a tactic of civil disobedience to threaten the use of, to promote a particular interest, then that can be thought of as being a terrorist act, potentially. So what we think is that the scope of this particular endeavor is so wide that it gives them possibly the power to enact laws like that.
So just to draw you out, say I'm protesting at a political convention and I sit down and block traffic. That could be seen as use of force?
Yes, exactly. The threatened use of force and the use of force, yes. Because what's important is that the definition doesn't say the use of violence, but the threatened use of force and or use of force. And so it puts both of those things in the category of ideologically based violence, which has to be stopped according to this bill. And that's scary for folks who are not only activists or organizers or people who are concerned about particular issues and may come out for the first time. And, you know, after hearing that this kind of law gets passed, and once again, what the recommendations could be, instead of being charged with something like obstruction of governmental administration or disorderly conduct or even resisting arrest, the possibility is that you can be charged with a terrorist statute. And it only takes, you know, one incident for them to try to use this as a way of moving forward and stopping dissent or putting a chill on people's ability to go out there and do the kind of things that people normally would do when it comes to dissenting.
Well, and we certainly should be past the point of that would never happen in this country. Well, Network News, as we pointed out, has not really addressed this legislation. Dennis Kucinich, who was one of the six representatives to vote against it, he mentioned it in an interview on Fox. But there was a piece on NBC on November 10th that already illustrated how it might be employed. The headline on the transcript tells the story. It was, Los Angeles Police Department want to map Muslim communities to prevent homegrown acts of terror. Muslims angry. It's not only Muslims, clearly, who need to be concerned about the uses to which this act could be put.
Yeah, the other part of the bill, it hones in on looking at the internet and saying that the internet has facilitated in causing violent radicalization and ideologically based violence. So again, another fear is that the one of the recommendations that can come out of this is maybe they're tried to have a law in place that says that they need to filter certain information from being brought on through the internet. And as we know, I mean, I've talked about this, I've used Al Jazeera's as one possible thing to look at, like Al Jazeera's, which basically has denied cable access in the United States and gets its news covered only through being online. Well, if that's thought of as promoting terrorism or promoting an extremist belief system, as a lot of times that news outlet is posed as, then that's something that potentially the government could try to filter and stop from even having internet access to in the United States. So we think that it's scary because it legitimizes a lot of the tactics that the government has done in the past through its counterintelligence programs and the FBI and some of the things that it's still trying to do, and it's just trying to find more ways to make these things legal and to scare people by throwing out the term terrorism.
Well, let's talk about some of the folks behind it. I understand the RAND Corporation, that listeners will have heard of, had sort of a hand in this legislation, and they're on record, as I understand it, pointing to anti-globalization groups, environmental groups, animal rights groups as potential sources of domestic terrorism. They throw a pretty wide net, don't they?
Exactly correct. They actually testified in hearings for this bill and did exactly what you're talking about. Their terrorist expert, whose name is Brian Michael Jenkins, testified, and they say no less than that, that the terrorists and the anti-globalization crowd and anarchists and activists potentially, and environmentalists, I should throw in also, potentially will seek alliance with each other. I mean, that's, you know, that's a really scary thing if you're an anti-globalization activist to be tied to. And that's why the biggest fear is that this bill is more about coming down on dissent than it has anything to do with something that could potentially be narrowly tailored to even look at what terrorism is. What instead they've done is created a wide breadth of different causes and issues and claimed that all of that can lead to terrorism. And I think that is something that people need to fight against pretty soon.
And then you say it could lead to terrorism, and then suddenly leading to terrorism or potentially leading to terrorism becomes terrorism, and then it all collapses together. Well, as we record this show in December, Senate Bill 1959 is still in the Senate. I'm wondering what folks could or should do about it at this stage, and how can our listeners learn more about it?
The things that we're recommending for people, and we being the Center for Constitutional Rights, is probably two things. One, obviously, is getting informed about what the bill is, what's contained in the bill. And it's not a long bill, so it's something that people can easily access. And we've posted sort of an analysis of the bill on our website, which is ccrjustice.org. Again, ccrjustice.org. In addition to that, what we want people to do is to call their senators at this point and to let them know that this is not a bill that they want them to vote for, that this is a bill that they think should die in the committee. I think it's right now in Joe Lieberman's committee, and it should stay there, and that it shouldn't see the light of day, and that we don't want them voting for this bill, for the Congress to create this commission to be able basically to broadly cast everything as a terrorist act.
We've been speaking with Kamal Carl Franklin, Racial Justice Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I should note, a former FAIR intern. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.